Valerie, I think counsel was trying to say that he cannot see Judge Carnes on this screen. Got it fixed now. Judge Carnes, we could, Judge Abudu and I could see you from the bench, but counsel could not see you from the screen that was facing counsel, so we've now got that rectified.
Okay, I hope counsel will be consoled by the fact it was no big loss.
Okay, Mr. Christina.
Yes. May it please the court, good morning.
Morning.
I'm Thomas Christina. I'm with Page Scranton in Columbus, Georgia. I'm here for Keyvon Sellers, the appellant today. Your Honors, this case is obviously a tragedy. We lost an inmate at our jail in Columbus, Georgia. Unfortunately, however, for the case, it's not a basis for civil liability against Keyvon Sellers. Keyvon Sellers was entitled and is entitled to qualified immunity, and the district court ruling denying Keyvon Sellers qualified immunity is an error, and it needs to be reversed for the reason that it was unprecedented. An unprecedented meaning.
Let me make sure I understand some things. So your client, Ms. Keyvon Sellers, knew that the detainee had not only had committed an aggravated assault, the sort that put him in maximum security for detention, right? But knew that he had stabbed a white store clerk because he was white. And knew that if there were some facts that could bear on his classification in the jail, that he could communicate that to classification officers and that they were receptive to that sort of thing, and it could affect their classification decisions. The classification officers testified that had they known the information Mr. Sellers knew, Officer Sellers knew, but did not communicate to them, that is, the racial motivation for his crime, it would have affected their classification. They would not have placed him in a cell with a white inmate, right? All of that is true, isn't it?
Yes, that's the facts drawn, life is favorable.
Which we have to do.
Wait for a question. My response to that is, though, Your Honor, is he's no different than any other inmate.
He is different from any other inmate. He knows a fact about them, about this inmate, that is different from lots of other inmates and about which the classification officers testified that had they known, it would have made a difference to them. And he knew that there could be facts about an inmate, about a detainee, that if he communicates to them, the classification officers are receptive to that, that there can be those kinds of facts. And he knows about this particular fact. You know, it's hard to avoid qualified immunity in these deliberate indifference types cases, but wow, this looks like the kind of record that does it.
Well, Your Honor, my concern with that is how to distinguish Keyvon Hatchett from the other murderers and other folks that come in who commit aggravated assault.
Well, the way you distinguish it is those others who come in, Sellers doesn't know that there was a racial motivation for what they did, as he does with this inmate.
And I understand that, but to draw a distinction based on the racial motivation, they're equally as dangerous as the person that comes in who committed a murder.
They're not equally dangerous, though, to particular victims.
Well, I, I'm not sure that I agree with that, Your Honor. I understand the court's point. And what I would say in response to that is I don't know how you could say somebody who commits aggravated assault on the basis of race is any more dangerous than a murderer. And they're all.
I don't know that they're any more dangerous in a general sense, but they're certainly more likely to target. It's already been, they've already established that they're more likely to target a victim based on race. And that's avoidable by classifying this inmate not only to maximum security, but to ensure that this person's not put in a cell with someone for whom they've already shown they have a racial motivation for the kind of violence that has put them in maximum security.
Your Honor, my response to that would be, I understand the court's point, and it is troubling that you have the situation happen, but if we turn to the qualified immunity analysis and you compare the ruling from Judge Land to the opinions we cited, Brooks, Marbury, Carter, Goodman, Brown, none of those cases would have told Kevon Sellers that he needed to isolate Javon Hatchett or lose his qualified immunity. Now we have Rodriguez and we have Bowen, which was Judge Karn's case, but those cases are so dissimilar. And my understanding of the 14th Amendment and the qualified immunity analysis, and the reason I said that I felt like Judge Land's ruling was unprecedented, is because you got to have a case squarely on point. So if the courts...
Well, it's the law's clear, is clearly established that the jailer cannot disregard what is an obvious risk of serious injury, right? I mean, the standards that are governing this inquiry here are very well established. And it cannot be that just because we don't have those particular facts where the risk is obvious, that the officer gets qualified immunity, unless you come up with a second case that involves exactly the same facts.
I couldn't find any cases that deal with somebody charged with a hate crime coming into jail who's then must be isolated. What Kevon Sellers and the correctional officers and the intake officers are dealt with is how to interpret the cases that do exist. And when you look at the specificity of the risks and the immediacy of the risks in the cases that we've cited, and the fact that the court found no constitutional violation, and compare that with both.
Let's assume that the facts were the opposite, were a little bit changed.
Yes,
this was a white supremacist who was upset by the same events that were going on in terms of racial protest. And felt like the thing to do was to go out and stab the first black person that he saw, right? He's a skinhead, and that's how he chooses to act out. You think it'd be okay to put him in the cell with a black inmate, a black detainee?
I think it's a different set of facts, but I would not quarrel with the fact that once he came into the jail, if he displayed behavior in such a way as to concern the correctional officer, that he should have advised the classification folks. But what makes this case different is that
the difficulty with that, counsel, is you're basically saying it gets one assault or murder. You got to wait till he lashes out at somebody because of race and kills or injures them before you have an obligation to do anything about it. That's not really reasonable, is it?
It's an unfortunate situation, but it is my understanding of the law, and I understand the general principle of deliberate indifference in the general sense. But the way these cases that I've read from this court have been, you've got to get into the facts and put yourself in Kevon Sellers' shoes as to what he saw.
So in that vein, one of my questions is, when do we start the clock in terms of what decision should have been made? Is it the basis for Hatchett's arrest, which I don't think there's any debate was racially motivated, or is it after Hatchett is in a cell with another white inmate, Nolan, doesn't do anything for days, then has another white inmate, Nelson, come in, is in there, from what I understand from the record, a couple of days, and then nothing happens. But now, I guess I'm just trying to understand, is the decision that it sounds like my colleagues are suggesting start because of the basis of the arrest, or does it start after some kind of altercation with the first white inmate that Hatchett encounters?
Thank you, Judge. And my response to that would be, I think you have to look at the particular defendant to decide when the clock starts. In our case, we're dealing with an intake officer whose job is to process the inmate in. Now, if the inmate displays behavior while he's observing him, the clock starts right there for him as to what he needs to do. And what he observed was no threat, no present threat, no threat at any time.
No, that's not exactly right, though, is it? Because the intake officer, your client, can learn facts. He admits this, that if he knows presents some kind of risk, he has a duty to communicate to the classification officers. He admits that, right? He can learn specific facts about a specific detainee. He says the classification officers are receptive to that, and he can have a duty to communicate those facts, right? That's true.
Yes, but in this situation, that would have required him to go further and interrogate.
He knows this, though. He could have taken this inmate and not asked any questions and not learned anything about him, in which case we wouldn't be here, okay? But that's not what happened. He learned these specific facts about this particular detainee and failed to communicate them to classification officers who testified that had they been told those facts, it would have made a difference to them. They would not have placed him in a cell with a white inmate. Isn't that right?
He did not communicate that because he was not, it didn't impact him in such a way that he felt he needed to. And that's the subjective component, which we've argued. But
a reasonable jury could find that the serious risk that was presented by the fact he knew was so obvious that he should have communicated it. Or otherwise, it can't be. You're not arguing, are you, that any time an officer says, "Well, I didn't think that." That every officer gets qualified immunity.
It can be proved by circumstantial evidence, yes, sir. But my point is that, again, this to distinguish him from the many other folks at that jail who are extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
We deal with them all the time, and I understand drawing a distinction. As I put in my brief, it makes sense from some perspectives that maybe this is the way we need to go. If somebody's charged with a hate crime, they have to be isolated. And my time is up. Let's finish this. But that's simply not the law. And to go the other way is to do what Judge Land did, which is to say, in a general sense, if you know of a substantial,
you misunderstand your problem. His liability is not because he failed to isolate this man from the rest of the prison population. His liability is narrow and focused. He didn't tell the intake officer. He doesn't have to go interview him. He doesn't have to ask questions. Once he tells the intake officer, he's done.
And I appreciate that distinction, Judge, and my response to that would be that again, there's no authority out there that would tell him that he would need to do that under this specific set of facts.
And okay.
I do have just one question, though, and this goes to mine of timing. So let's say that Officer Sellers made a mistake. He should have said something at the very beginning, but he didn't. And then Hatchett ends up being housed with a white inmate, and nothing happens. And then Sellers remembers what he was told before, but now the facts show that Hatchett has been living with a white inmate with no threats of violence. I believe Nolan never complained, said that they were having conversations that were pretty genial. So does Sellers still have an obligation at that point, or does the jail have an obligation at that point to segregate Hatchett from white inmates?
If we hold that he had an obligation to do something in the beginning, I think certainly that he would have an obligation to do something later on, because while it wasn't...
Of course, that assumes that there's another fact that I don't think is in this record, which is that he knew what happened afterward. That Sellers knew how he ended up, who he ended up in a cell with.
He did observe him for a number of days, up or 3 days, I believe, on the floor where he was housed. I don't believe there's testimony in the record from Sellers that he knew he was in a cell with a white inmate.
Right, we don't know that fact. And part of the time he's in the cell with a white inmate, he's also in the cell with another inmate, right?
Yes, sir. The transition was Hatchett was with one white inmate for a bit, then a black inmate came in, then Nelson, and then Nelson was left alone with Hatchett.
Yeah, then Nelson, a different white inmate from the first inmate. We don't, okay.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I don't think I can improve upon Judge Lynn's analysis. I rarely can, or the points raised by the court in this argument, and I don't really intend to say anything else about the merits of the case unless y'all have specific questions for me. I would like to make a comment from a judicial administration standpoint that this case is here on an interlocutory appeal from a denial of qualified immunity. The only issue that should be raised here is whether the law is clearly established, which it clearly is. And when Judge Land initially ruled on this case at the pleading stage, he denied their motion to dismiss. And in that order, this is what he said. Defendants do not dispute that it was clearly established before September 5th, 2020, the jail officials have a duty to protect inmates from violence at the hands of other inmates, and that officials can be liable if they knew of a substantial risk of inmate or inmate violence but disregarded that risk and failed to take reasonable measures to minimize it. So all of a sudden they're raising it now in the 11th Circuit, and my concern is that the collateral order doctrine is being abused increasingly so by defendants who just want a second bite at the apple to argue solely about disputed facts, which Mr. Christina's got some fine arguments he needs to make to a jury, but it doesn't need to be cluttering up the docket of this court when the law is clearly established and when Johnson v. Jones, the Supreme Court, said if it's a question of fact or if it's a mixed question of law and fact, it's not proper for immediate review. And Chief Pryor, you wrote a very, very wonderful decision about a month ago in a case called English versus Fowler, where you dismissed a case for lack of jurisdiction.
Counsel, I'm a little confused about your premises. What factual dispute is there in this case?
I thought I was cutting it as it comes to us. I don't think there is any factual dispute that is essential.
Then the defendant has an extraordinarily well established right to bring up any legal issues that play into the qualified immunity denial.
The case, but I think in this case that the law is clearly established, and we're basically arguing what they're basically.
So you think this is a frivolous appeal?
I don't
understand why you're taking that on. Why don't you just explain to us why there's no basis for it?
Well,
in my mind,
I think you guys already did a good job of that, and I think Judge Land did a good job of that. I'm simply making an observation that I spent a lot of time on these every single...
On interlocutory appeals from denials of qualified immunity. Yeah, but you know, but Mr. Jones, I think Judge Garn's point is, look, the Supreme Court has said that if there is a denial of qualified immunity, it's immunity from suit, that's important enough, that there are collateral orders, that we have jurisdiction to decide, and we have no, you know, we don't really have a choice about that. There's clearly jurisdiction. There's really not a dispute of fact. It's whether those facts provide for a clearly established constitutional violation if we view the facts in the light most favorable to your client. And you don't think that we should, as a matter of decreed language, dismiss this appeal, right? You think we should affirm Judge Land. But what you think we ought to do is affirm, isn't it?
Well, then, counsel, we're not here to hear observations. We're here to hear your position on the issues and to ask you questions, one of which I'll put to you, and this may not be dispositive by any stretch, but I'd like to know. Suppose Hatchett had killed a black inmate. Same set of facts, exactly, except it's a black cellmate that he kills. Would there be any liability on Sellers' part in this case?
It would depend upon additional facts, but certainly in this case...
What additional facts?
Sir?
Yeah, no, take the facts that we have. Everything exactly the same, except he, without provocation, murders a black inmate.
Yeah.
Is that a risk that is clearly established? Sellers has got clearly established law against him, and he has liability or not? Does he have qualified immunity?
Well, in the Bowen v. Warden case, in 2016, this court held that in 2010 that irrespective of race wasn't an issue in that case, but if there's information that suggests that the attacker posed a specific risk of serious harm to any potential cellmate, end quote, that there's...
The facts in Bowen were that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. They knew it in the prison system, and that he had previously assaulted without provocation another inmate.
That's correct. He was also...
We do not have those facts in this case. I'm just exploring how far you would have us go.
I would submit that there's no material difference between somebody who was convicted of a murder a year ago and somebody who was who tried to murder somebody because of the color of their skin days earlier, and then were told the booking officer and an intake nurse that he wanted to kill a white person.
Well, so, Counselor, so you're, excuse me, so you're making this case about race. I think that's clear, but I think what opposing counsel has mentioned is that the main thing is that Hatchett was arrested for murder. And so I think to Judge Karn's question, does it matter? I mean, so you all have argued that, you know, he was killed because he was white, but would it really matter at the end of the day in terms of any relief or remedy that your clients are entitled to? Isn't it the real fact that he was murdered? So even if he had murdered a black inmate, that black inmate's family would still have some avenue of relief, correct?
I think that's correct. Under the Warden case, under the Catone case, under other cases by this circuit, which is a risk posed by a particular inmate, there's a duty. And the question...
I'm confused by that, Mr. Jones. I thought that your argument was that the liability here turned on the fact that there was something about the motivation for this detainee's crime.
Yes.
It was not communicated to the intake officers. Now, had the detainee who was a victim here, who was strangled to death, been black, okay? I think the classification officers knew what the offense was,
right?
They didn't know the motivation, racial motivation, but they knew the offense. They knew this was a dangerous inmate with a propensity for violence, right?
Yes.
And they classified him accordingly. That is, they put him in maximum security detention, right?
Yes.
So I don't understand your argument that there would still be a deliberate indifference case for Sellers, for the intake officer, had the victim been black.
I'm not trying to make the argument. I'm trying to answer a hypothetical question about facts that we don't have before us.
Okay.
And I guess my mistake was I thought I was doing y'all a favor by trying to give you advice about how to deal with some of these.
Let's get back to, I think Judge Carnes had asked, and I understand that Judge Abudu was trying to really get at the same thing. The racial motivation really matters to your case, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It wouldn't matter if the attacker was a Klansman who had burned a cross in somebody's yard and had a swastika on his forehead. You know, the outcome would be the same.
So if race is what matters, what significance is it or does the facts in the case that, number one, again, Hatchett had been housed with two white inmates, or at least one white inmate, no issue, with Nelson for a few days before things escalated to the very tragic death, admittedly, that the comment apparently that Hatchett made before he murdered Mr. Nelson was, "You put hair in my sandwich." So there, and that also, they were talking about racial things, but it's not clear in the record what racial things that they were talking about. So doesn't that negate to some extent this argument that the motivation was racial as opposed to it being a murderer housed with someone that he might have had a propensity to murder?
I would hope they argue that to a jury, but I mean, that's a jury argument. But let me also point out that he was actually housed with two white inmates. He couldn't overpower two. He only overpowered one. And when the other white inmate was released, for some reason, this man, who was apparently delusional, who obviously had mental health problems, for which he received treatment in jail, he woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning, many hours after dinner time, and decided that my client's husband and brother had put a hair in his sandwich and decided for whatever reason to kill him. That may or may not have been racially motivated, but what we know is they shouldn't have been in a cell together.
Mr. Nelson was, I believe, arrested for failing to register as a sex offender, correct?
I believe that's the case.
Do you know whether or not there was any segregation of him or classification based on his sex offense?
I think he was classified, and the reason they were housed together was because of the sex offense. And that's an unfortunate thing about the classification system, because this was a man who had had an affair, had a relationship with an underage woman years earlier, which was consensual by her parents until they broke up and there was a big falling out. So that's probably a different class of sex offense than somebody who goes around.
I was just really trying to understand what level of classification or review Mr. Nelson received as well.
Sex offense made him maximum, and you know, we can argue about whether that's a good system or not. It's not something I was able to litigate because, one, there's no deliberate indifference involved, and two, it's discretionary. So even if we think it's a negligent system, it's not something for which there'd be liability under state law.
So let me make sure I've got some facts before you sit down, because you said that he was housed with Hatchett was housed with two white man, but not initially, right? He was assigned to cell 3E6, where he had one fellow detainee, a fellow inmate. Pardon me?
I don't remember all
this. Ray Nolan, a white man.
Okay.
Eddie Nelson, another white inmate, the victim,
yes,
joins the next day.
Okay.
And then the three men are living together until August 31st, I think. Nolan transfers to a different cell. And the next day, Clifford Shepherd, a black man, joins the two in cell 3E6. They're housed together until September 4th. So we've got most of this time we've got three, but there are some periods where there's only one, and the one is Mr. Nelson. They're housed together without issue until September the 4th, on which date Shepherd's relocated, leaving Hatchett and Nelson alone. And it's the next day, the 5th, the morning of the 5th, that the assault occurs, right?
I think that's correct. And in the post and after he was seen by mental health after this incident, it came up that Mr. Hatchett and Mr. Nelson had, quote, talked about racial things, and a notation was made in the file that Mr. Hatchett should not be housed with members of the white race. That fact was probably just as true before the assault happened. But I think that's why we have juries. And my only point about the law being clearly established is that I don't think that's really in dispute here. And if you consider the anomalous situation that there's a co-defendant employed by a medical contractor who's guilty of the same sin, who does not have a qualified immunity defense, who's going to go to trial anyway, I feel like
okay.
This is just
okay.
Before you sit down, counsel, let me ask you this, because I don't know how far the decision in this case will go or should go, but suppose you have someone on the outside who just hates people. We've run into all that before. He just hates people. And he, without provocation, kills a white man, and then soon thereafter a black man, and then soon thereafter a Hispanic man. And he is sent to prison. Now, would the prison have any different obligation in that case than in this case?
I don't
as
so.
To okay, so the
obvious risk.
I'm trying to figure out what role race plays here. I guess, in other words, does it mean that a certain percentage of the population is at risk, but not all the population? Whatever role that plays, or does it mean that the remedy that they should take, the precaution they should take, the measures they should take, are narrower in our case, this case, than in the hypothetical case? All you got to do in this case, I quote, all you got to do is blink in the reality of prison population. But all you got to do in this case is keep him away from white inmates. But in my example, you got to keep him away from all the inmates. That's your position, right?
No, my position is that there's an obvious risk, which is caused by the racial animus in this case. If it's not,
well, there's an obvious risk. No, you can't avoid my hypothetical. There's an obvious risk from the fact that he hates all people. Let's say all people. Everybody who's got a Y chromosome, he's no problem with women, but he's after the guys, and he's going to kill as many of them as he can. That doesn't play into deliberate indifference, except as to the population at risk and the remedy or requirement to take protective steps, right?
Well, if that fact's communicated to the booking officer, inmates are isolated all the time. There are people who can't be housed with anyone else. It would just depend upon what information was known at the time of booking. And the booking officer's job is to simply pass that on to the classification officer, who makes those decisions based upon a grid and based upon the training that they have. And the only reason, again, I mentioned the option of dismissal
But the prior crimes of violence, though, I think the record's pretty clear here. Yeah. The prior crimes of violence of the hypothetical detainee Judge Carnes is discussing would have affected classification, right?
It would. Absolutely. And all I'm saying is you don't need to do...
How would it... I thought you told us earlier, and I didn't remember this in brief, it was put maximum security. In this case,
classification, yes.
Yes, right. And the classification officers also testified that had they known this fact, yes, it would have further affected where they placed him in a cell, right?
And there's a concern about, if you're concerned about a decision that might affect other hypothetical cases, if you simply rule that the law is clearly established in this case and an interlocutory appeal is not proper to determine if the law is clearly established, you don't have to...
Mr. Jones, come on. All right, Mr. Christina.
Judge Pryor, you're correct that he spent one night with Ray Nolan and just the two of them.
Right.
Everything else he said was accurate based on the timeline we have in the case.
Right.
I give you my best case. If a ruling in this case denying qualified immunity will be the first one from the 11th Circuit that I'm aware of or the Supreme Court that bases that denial of an intake officer based on what somebody did before they got to jail, not based on what they did in jail.
He's right, is he not, that it's clearly established that the officers have an obligation to prevent inmate-on-inmate violence, right?
Absolutely. As a general principle, but when you
let's say the facts had been that that despite the horrible violence of this crime, take away the racial motivation of it, they put him in minimum security detention, right? And there was evidence that placement made his strangulation of another inmate more likely, even more likely than what happened here. There'd be a deliberate indifference claim there, wouldn't there?
In the classification sense, yes, sir, absolutely.
But we have undisputed testimony from the classification officers that had they known about the racial motivation of this detainee's crime, it would have affected their placement. They would not have placed him with a white inmate, right? So that's just one extra classification fact that is undisputed, it seems to me.
I agree with you, interpreted to the plaintiff's favor, sure, but my point's different.
They did testify to that, didn't they?
Yes.
Do you have any contrary testimony from them?
No, my counter to it is that they didn't see what Kevon Sellers saw. They answered a question that was asked them. If you were told that he killed a white guy and wanted to kill a white guy, I forgot how he phrased it. It's a different question.
Because he was a white guy.
They didn't see what Kevon Sellers saw. So that's the way we would fight that in front of a jury.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but it would have affected classification.
It would have.
In the same way that whether it's a violent crime or a nonviolent crime affects classification. You've just admitted that if it's a violent crime, of course that affects classification. If they don't take that into account, it could give rise to a deliberate indifference claim.
Again, in this case, though, Judge, we're saying that he has to be isolated simply because of the hate crime aspect, which is horrible. But that is totally unique. And Kevon Sellers should not have to bear that burden. That's what qualified immunity is for, in the sense that if there's not a case on point, Bowen wasn't on point.
Okay.
He's entitled to qualified immunity.
Okay.
Would it be
counsel?
Go ahead, Judge Carnes.
Yes.
No, I'm waiting on you. You started first, Judge. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering if it would be different. Here we're talking about a murder, very high stakes. Is it different if we were talking about just a dislike of other races, a dislike that could be had by officers as well, COs? I mean, to what extent are you suggesting, or I guess are you concerned that the other side would be suggesting how far we should go when it comes to segregating people in prisons based on race, especially when the Supreme Court has talked about moving in a direction against that?
That's exactly my concern. 2005, Johnson v. California, you can't segregate based on race. And in this situation, a blanket holding is going to have massive implications.
That's about segregation of entire classifications of prisoners, right?
Yes.
Not prisoner specific classifications, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir. But my point is that when you go down this road, it is a concern.
But tell me this though. If that's a concern, then we can't have hate crime prosecutions. I mean, if what we're dealing with is an individual-specific propensity to violence with a racial motivation, and taking that into account, if that's an impermissible consideration, then we can't have hate crime laws, can we?
The veracity of hate crime laws I'm not familiar with, but what I can say that certainly...
Well, they would be vulnerable to attack on the same argument, wouldn't they?
There is no distinction between aggravated assault based on race, and yes, it would.
But we prosecute. I mean, the state and federal governments prosecute individuals because of their racial motivations or religious motivations or whatever. You know, there's certain protected classification type motivations, and you get heightened penalties for that all the time.
And to my best point, Judge, given all that. Why is there no other case? I looked forever to find one like this. I can't find it anywhere in this country.
Maybe because other classification officers are smarter about what they communicate to each other.
Your Honor, there's so many cases. I appreciate that, but I disagree respectfully. Judge Farnsworth, do you have a question for me?
The sandwich statements that Hatchett made, that doesn't go to anything other than causation, does it?
The comment that the classification officer
I thought Hatchett gave as an explanation for why he did it that he, the victim, had put an insect, I thought it was a fly, in his sandwich. Am I wrong about that?
You are right about that, and that you are correct. I didn't understand your question. I'm sorry, Judge Carnes. That goes to classification. As to causation.
But not to any of the issues we've been discussing.
We haven't discussed causation here today, but we did brief it and argue that we
it's a hair, right?
It was a hair in a sandwich, correct.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Christina. We have your case. We'll move to the last one. Land.